Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, Knicks? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome. Welcome, all of you. In whatever form you come in, whatever you're doing, I hope you're not up to something too dubious. I hope you're trying. I got people coming in out of the garage. I'm having the talks. I'm connecting with folks. Most of them strangers, but most of them people that I've admired or certainly have tucked away into the compartments of what define me in my brain culturally. Like today on the show, John Lurie, who some of you may remember from the Lounge Lizards. Some of you might know him from the Jarmusch movies he did, Down by Law and Stranger Than Paradise. And he was in The Last Temptation of Christ. Some of you might know him from some of his other music. He's now a painter, but he was definitely a presence back in my brain back in high school when some dude laid that Lounge Lizards album on me, that first Lounge Lizards, and just seeing, you know, John there with his saxophone and having that intensity he naturally has. I was like, who the fuck is that guy? And then I'd see him in the groovy movies. I'm like, this dude means business. And he had this sort of kind of a philosophical crankiness to him that I definitely thought, like, you know, that guy is a guy I'd probably like. And now, like, decades later, after a short spat on Twitter about bullshit, you know, he shows up in L.A. He comes here with his assistant. He's here doing some painting business, moving the paintings and, visiting the States, a reprieve from his island retreat. And he stopped by. And we had kind of a loopy discussion, and then I took him out for Mexican food, and it continued there. And I got the feeling that he might not go if I didn't need to do other things. But we had a great time, and that's coming up in a little bit. That's coming your way. He's a guy that's conquered some demons, and not unlike any of us, is still in the throes of the struggle with others. Going on the road tomorrow. I know some of you are coming to see me in Lincoln and in Iowa City and in Kansas City. I think Lincoln, Nebraska on Saturday at the Rococo Theater is sold out. I think that the Mission Creek Festival at the Englert on Friday, tomorrow, might be getting close to that. I'm not sure where Kansas City is on Sunday at the Arvest Bank Theater at the Midland. But I'm heading out, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the shows because I don't know what's going to come out of me, and yeah, I'm a little hard on myself, and I think that we're going to have a interesting and funny evening, all of them, unless I completely lose my mind. But I'm looking forward to the driving. There's something about the driving. It used to work. I sure hope the driving works still as a meditative exercise, just getting out there and letting your brain kind of relax and go where it's going to go without freaking out, and you're grounded by the innate physical need to drive the car, and hopefully nothing will jump in front of the car and jar my meditative state or wreck my rent-a-car. Don't want that to happen again. Let's read a couple of emails. Hello there, Mark. This is a subject line, hello from the UK. Hello there, Mark. I never write these emails. In fact, this is the first. I am a theater director, and my work sees me bounce up and down the UK and across Europe like a fucking yo-yo. Since dragging myself away from alcohol a year and a half ago, I have had to booby-trap my life with habits, random things outside of my job to keep my shit balanced, a series of things to help find interest in the solitary velvet jail that is life on the road. One of the things that anchors me and crowbars my brain out of whatever project I am working on is your podcast. Your barking through the internet into my headphones does me the world of good. I'm grateful for this, dude. I'm currently directing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream up in Scotland, 300 miles from my home in Manchester. In my production, the Duke plays blues guitar as the audience enters. He is drunk and is at the end of a long, long party. As the lights change to begin the play, I've asked the actor playing the Duke to growl, "Boomer lives." It felt like a suitably cryptic springboard to open the play. I hope you don't mind. Thanks again for WTF. Thank you, Jonathan. I don't mind at all. I'm more than honored to be part of a Willie the Shake production. You know, me and Shakespeare have a tenuous relationship, but I hope he's posthumously happy that I'm cryptically involved in the unfolding of one of his magnificent masterpieces of theater. Thank you. And I'm serious. I'm not being condescending. I'm completely being honest. This is a similar one, but it's a little more intense. So I'm going to roll through it with the energy that this guy wrote it. Subject line: "Hey, Mark, thanks for everything. Hey, Mark, my name's Joseph, and it's a little hard to believe I've probably been following the template laid out by all of your other fans with this email, the quick grab for attention, the explanation that I love your show and relate to you and want you to keep doing the good work. All that's true, and I guess I don't have anything more important to say than anyone else, but if you're interested, I'm a Southerner, and fuck, man, it isn't all picking crawdads out of the creek and barefoot playing. I live about 10 minutes from a fuck ugly statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest, and that's a problem. I'm a writer, which means I write things down and then don't get paid for them, like the swaths of other artists that listen to your show. When you talk about struggling with your comedy but doing it for the love of it, well, that hits me deep, dude. I know I do the same with writing because I have been. Oh, here comes the obligatory drug sharing story, but I've been sober for about 5 months this go around. It was tearing me up, and no one wants to read someone who's less stream of consciousness and more long form bitching and self-aggrandizing, less Joyce or Faulkner and more shitting the bed. Last time I got fucked up, I drank bourbon, which I still miss, but at least only half the time now, bought heroin to take the edge off, like playing Jenga with your sanity, and passed out. I woke up Sunday morning like a Velvet Underground song and then smoked some crack with one of my lovely neighbors. Jesus, dude, I don't know if you've partaken, but it was like inhaling adrenaline smoke laced with flies. I was a live wire. Once was enough for me, and I'd be lying if I said you hadn't played a significant role in my recovery. It's not an exaggeration to say that my girlfriend, my best friend in the world, and you have all been there for me in different ways. I still crave that junk. I still smoke like a train, and I'm still trying to keep up the will to write and put my stuff out there. This has been long and convoluted, but I just wanted to shout out and say I think you're doing great work. You're a hilarious comedian and my ghost of Christmas recovery. Next time you come to Nashville, look out for a long-haired blonde dude with crescents under his eyes. Sincerely, Joseph." Good job, man. Stay with it, Joseph. Seems like you're on a roll. Am I right? Yeah. All right. So, John Lurie, I got to tell you, I was a little nervous about this because he struck me, you know, just from my experience with him as a fan and in movies. And, oh, Fishing with John was something I didn't mention. Marvin Pontiac, another thing. You know, from some of my my assumptions about him, I thought it might be a little volatile. So I was a little edgy, but it worked out pretty good. And we had a nice time and a nice dinner after this conversation that we had that you were about to hear. You can go to johnlurieart.com to check out everything John makes. Beautiful painter. This is his song "Small Car" off the album The Legendary Marvin Pontiac Greatest Hits. Know one other guy, two other people that have the Lyme's disease.
Oh, a lot of people have it.
Right, no, but me personally.
Yeah.
So I don't know what, you know, what the hell, how do you fucking figure out you have it? What, I mean, where'd you get, did you get it when you were fishing?
I mean, I got it, I got Lyme disease in the Hamptons or North Haven in 1994.
So you've known that long?
Well, no.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you take the antibiotics.
Yeah.
And then it's supposed to be gone. At least back in 1994, that's what they thought.
Right.
And then about 4 or 5 years later, I started having what they said, oh, you've got chronic fatigue. Because I would just get, you know, I would get dizzy and achy. And I was on that TV show, Oz. Right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And I used to be able to remember 20 pages of dialogue.
Yeah.
Now I got 4 lines, and I'm reading them over and over again. I'm recording them and hearing them back. I can't remember my 4 lines.
Right.
And then they told me that, you know, new characters are naked on the show. So I started working out like crazy because I wanted to, you know.
Yeah.
And I worked out one day, and then I had this attack.
Ugh.
Like you're on LSD.
Yeah.
In a boat.
Yeah.
In a storm.
Yeah.
And your heart's doing this weird stuff, and you can't walk in a straight line, and your vision's... So I went to the hospital, and no, you're not having a heart attack. And I just thought it's one of those weird things.
Right, happened. Right. Age, anxiety, something.
Then 3 days later, it happened again.
Like you go out, you trip, and your vision gets fucked up, and your heart's beating too fast.
You get migraine aura. I get this thing where my vision would be like static electricity almost.
Oh, my God.
Roaring in your ears.
Yeah, yeah.
Prickling like bee stings almost in your nerves.
Really?
And your heart doing weird stuff, and... My left leg wouldn't work, you know.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's a horrible, but when you don't know.
You know what's fucked up about me, the Jew that I am? I'm sitting here going, oh, maybe that's what I have.
So now you think you've got it? Cause...
No, I just have these weird, for years, I've had like tingling and achy hands and feet. And, you know, that's a fairly standard anxiety issue. And I've gone to doctors.
Yeah.
They did the, I did MRI. I did, you know, reflex it to see if I had neuropathy. Nothing. I got nothing. And it's just sort of there. Sometimes I notice it, sometimes I don't. But my hands and feet feel like they're electric sometimes.
Well, that's one of the things. I get this electric thing down my left arm and left leg. Like it's like, you know.
Like a shock, though.
Yeah.
Mine's sort of an ongoing current.
Yeah, it's an ongoing current. And then there's a shock thing, too.
But I don't know if I've had any other symptoms. I mean, how?
But you know. I mean, we all got shit wrong with us.
Yeah, I know. And you got to live with it, right?
And the neurologists have no idea what's going on.
Why can't they figure that shit out? We can go to space. Why can't they figure out the human vessel? Because it's relative to genetics and all kinds of other shit.
Well, that's really one of the things that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Because when you got Lyme, all your systems stop working. You have what's called a barrel gland or something, and its job, and they don't know how it works.
Yeah,
is to is to regulate the body so that the body knows when it's standing up or sitting down.
Uh-huh.
So they, you know, it increases the blood flow to the brain when you're standing up, but they don't know how it works.
Yeah,
the real miracle is. That we all have these barrel glands that work and take them for granted. But really what it comes down to is like, why is any of this shit actually working?
I know.
Why? I mean, that's the real... And so, of course, they don't
take
understand.
A lot for granted.
Yeah, we take a lot for granted.
I know. You know, it's just amazing that, you know, the consciousness, the curse of consciousness is that we just kind of go along until something goes wrong.
Well, this shit that happened to me, you would think it was really terrible, but really...
I didn't know what the hell to expect. I thought you were going to come in here like gray as a ghost, kind of shaky. And, you know, I got a phone call. We can't have any Windex in out here.
Well, that's really actually true.
Well, I don't have any out here, but I know.
I'm just saying that Windex in particular just like...
Really?
Yeah.
Knocks you out?
I can't think.
Really?
I cannot think. Windex in particular. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, so I guess for years then people thought you were probably losing your mind.
Well, no, I mean, I had 2002, and then I just started looking for what was wrong with me.
Uh-huh.
And it took me a long time, and then I finally found out it was Lyme, but that was like, it was 4 years before I was certain, because the Lyme people are so on a crusade to prove that their illness is real, especially back then.
Yeah.
And they were being persecuted by the insurance companies and, you know, the CDC.
Oh, right, they couldn't get any help.
Well, not only that, they were being sued. They would, you know, and then, you'd be diagnosed with Lyme and told that you have to be on IV antibiotics, but I can't give them to you.
Right.
So you have to get
find a guy.
You have to find a doctor or a GP who will put you on. And I found this great guy, this Dr. Kaufman, who did it. You know, I was sick for years in my apartment, and I would be so lonely.
In New York?
Yeah, and yet somebody would come by, and all they have to do is pick up a glass and put it on the table, and they go, oh, you can't do that.
Oh, my God. Like, your whole body hurt when they did that?
I mean, everything bothers you. Everything bothers you. It's just
And what about, who were you before that? A guy that nothing bothered?
No, I was always sensitive and cranky. I mean, you know.
So you're living with it, and you seem okay today anyways.
Yeah, it comes and goes. I mean, yeah.
When did you do the fishing show? What year was that?
We started in 91 and finished them in 93.
Oh, so this is before the Lyme.
Oh, way before the Lyme. And then, but then there was a legal problem with them, and I had to wait like 7 years to get them back. I didn't get it out till 98. I didn't edit them.
What was the legal problem?
Oh, it was a mess. I mean, this Japanese company had given me the money to do them.
Yeah.
It's a long...
Well, really, how many did you do?
Six.
So you did one with Tom.
Tom.
You did one with...
Jarmusch.
Yeah.
Two with Dennis Harper. Hopper.
Yeah.
Harper. Hopper.
Dennis Hopper, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Willem and Matt Dillon.
Willem Dafoe and Matt Dillon.
Yeah.
Interesting. Here's the funny thing about you is that I had the fucking first Lounge Wizards record when I was in like high school.
Oh, so you're younger than me? That's what you're
Yeah, a little bit. But yeah, what year was that, though? Because I don't remember how I got it or why.
79.
Right.
80.
Right.
79. 80.
Right. So I'm in
the
high school.
The band started in 79. The record came out in 81.
So someone gave me this record. I didn't know nothing about, you know, where jazz came from or what jazz was necessarily. And some hipster, a guy I knew at a record store, said, you got to listen to this.
Yeah.
And I listened to that, and I'm like, what the fuck is, what is happening? Like, it was one of those things where, you know, it kind of blew my mind and I couldn't stop listening to it, even though I didn't know, I didn't have enough foundation in music or in jazz to really get what you were doing. Was that the first thing you ever did, you know, in terms of artistic output?
No. I mean, I did a thing in London. No, I did a thing in, actually, the first thing I did was a thing in Boston in my apartment.
Yeah, was that a lot of people see that?
No, like eight, you know, like eight people. And then I did a couple things in London. And then the first thing I did in New York was this performance piece, which started with the saxophone solo. And then I made this tape of static electricity going, shh, shh. And I started swinging this, what looked like a baseball bat, was actually hollowed out balsa wood, so I could do going, and it would go faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. And the last section was I'd gone over to the docks and smashed all these glass windows and recorded it.
Yeah.
And I played over the top of that.
Yeah.
When I had my brother and some other people stand up and start screaming in the middle, you know, so.
God, why, you know, there was a time where you could do shit like that.
Yeah.
Now, let's
we
go.
We can still do shit like that.
No, I know,
that,
but like, you know, but back then, you know, that when there was a sort of kind of a chaotic performance art scene in New York, that there was stuff like that happening, you know, and some people were good at it, some people not so good at it, but people were compelled by it. You know, now, you know, as time goes on, you know, and
now you can still do it and lose your $500 to do it.
I know, but
people are so geared to like their career and you know.
Exactly, that, and the internet. Too. I mean, live performance is not what it used to be.
No.
So where do you come from?
Why do you point at me when you ask me that question?
Like, where that was do like, you...
Have you ever been a member?
Yeah. Where does this particular Jew
I was born in Minneapolis.
Isn't that weird?
Why?
Well, I mean, because I won't get too Semitic, but I'm always fascinated with the Midwestern Jewish population. Were your parents from there? Were
they my mother was Welsh Protestant. My dad was a New York Jew.
I want you to be all Jew. So no, I'm going to make you
was
all...
your mother Jewish? Was
yes,
your mother Jewish? But mine wasn't.
Yeah.
So
you read so Jew to me.
I do?
Yeah.
Okay. But
she's laughing. Am I right?
I do. I wasn't sure. I didn't know till now that you were Jewish.
Why hide it unless you know me? You got to know. Yeah.
You got to know?
I'm kind of Jewish.
Anyways.
I don't practice or anything, but, you know, culturally.
What was the question? How do we end up there?
Well, you're from Minneapolis, and I just know that there was this, I get sort of obsessed with where Jews, how they end up in, you know, the Midwest, and I know that, like, you know, the Dylan comes from there, and there was Mitzi Shore comes from there, and there was a Jewish community in the Midwest early.
Okay, that's not, my dad went to NYU.
Yeah.
And
to do what?
He wrote the whole literary magazine under pseudonyms and was going to be the next James Joyce.
Really?
But instead of writing, he went to the South and organized farm workers.
Mm.
And then after the war, he was labeled as a communist.
After the Second World War?
Mm-hmm. He went to the Second World War. That's where he met my mom. They went to Germany for a while. They moved to Harlem. And then he couldn't get work. And he sold Israeli bonds, which there was a lot of old commies in. And they put him in Minneapolis to start their first thing.
Oh, yeah? And to sell bonds?
Yeah. And then they moved us to New Orleans.
Really?
Yeah.
So how old were you when you moved to New Orleans?
Six.
What'd you take in? What do you remember? What hit you in the head?
Well, I became obsessed with snakes.
Oh, yeah?
I would go and hunt for snakes every day.
There's a lot of snakes in your paintings. There's a few. I've seen a few snakes.
Yeah. They get boring to paint, but yeah, there's some snakes in the paintings. Obama was making fun of you for having all the pictures of yourself on the wall, and I was going to send you a print of one of the paintings.
I want a painting. How much did I go for?
Well, I'll send you one for in here.
Yeah.
And then every time Obama comes, you go, that's a John Lurie painting.
John Lurie?
Yes, because if he buys one, then, because the whole art world thing is.
I know, dating a painter right now.
It's just who bought your painting.
Oh, yeah. It's 10 people, the art world.
It's 10 people. And it's it's the worst high school clique you ever came across. Yeah. But we just had this great thing in Italy, which was just so, because I was getting fed up.
Yeah.
We had a show in Milan. It's still up. The gallery was wonderful. The curator was wonderful. The press was wonderful. I mean, it was just like...
Everything worked.
It was just for real. It was just...
Did you sell some?
Yeah, a whole bunch.
Oh, it's great.
It's great because we were down to like bumping along the bottom with money there. Yeah, really kind of got bad.
So you moved to New Orleans. Yeah. You're obsessed with snakes. How long were you there?
2 years.
No music entered.
Might have done, but I'm not sure.
And then where do you go?
Worcester, Massachusetts.
Wow. What year was that?
The year the world ended. What year would that have been?
I know a few people from Worcester.
What year would that have been? I was born in 52. I mean, I must have been 9.
But so Worcester was still a functioning, relatively industrial city. It wasn't
As opposed
broken.
To what it is now?
It's a little beat up. By the time I was in the Boston area.
It was a rough place. It was a rough place.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like the bus station there, it really feels like there's a dome over Worcester and God isn't allowed in. It really is kind of bleak.
The end of the line.
Yes.
Where'd you go to college?
I didn't go to college.
So when did the music start?
Why aren't you going to point at me when you ask that? When did you go to college?
When did you go to college? And then you go, I didn't go to college. I knew it!
My dad died my senior year in high school or I would have gone to college.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was a big academic. He was all about academics.
Oh, so you were on your way, and then he passed away, and you were like, I ain't going?
Well, he passed away like the week before my college boards, and I colored them in with like turkeys chasing pilgrims. Oh, you know, and then
they didn't. How'd he pass?
Emphysema.
Smoker?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you smoke?
Yeah.
Anymore. Yeah. Yeah,
Do you smoke?
No, not anymore. I take these nicotine lozenges constantly.
I chew the gum constantly.
I love these. These are like candy. You suck on them. They're the best. The gum, like, eventually you just keep chewing it even when the shit's gone. This stuff, you actually have a little more control over. You can pace it out. It's like having a real nice, comforting drug experience. Like if this is 4 milligrams, so in the morning...
Are they paying you to say this?
No, dude. They're not.
Don't call me dude.
All right, man.
Thank you.
Bro, listen.
Bro. Ayo.
But where does the music come in? When do you start blowing a harp? When do you start, like, what was going on in high school? Because, you're an impressive musical mind that did some weird shit, and I want to know how that happened.
My sister gave my brother a harmonica for his birthday.
Yeah.
When he's 14, I'm 15, or 15 and 16.
Yeah.
And I stole it from him. And got good on it really, really fast.
From listening to, did you like the
little
music?
Little Walter.
Juke.
We became so obsessed with Little Walter.
Roller Coaster? Could you play Roller Coaster?
Yeah.
No shit.
No, I could play. I mean, within a year, I could play it. I sat in with Candy Eat and John Lee Hooker.
Damn.
And Mississippi Fred McDowell.
Where?
You know, Mississippi Fred McDowell was in Worcester. He was playing there, and somebody said, John, take out your harmonica. Take out your... And so in between songs, I finally did. I sort of like did a riff, and he invited me up on stage.
No shit. Now, was he? He was just him, right? On acoustic.
Yeah.
And that was his resurgence by that point. The Mississippi, like, when they went and found him, and they. So he's playing slide guitar, and you're riffing. How was it? A big crowd, or was it a folk crowd?
No, it was
a bar.
It was some coffee shop.
But you went to see him, huh?
Yeah, sure.
Great. And then with Canned Heat and John Lee Hooker together.
We hitchhiked from Worcester to New York.
Yeah.
To see them at Carnegie Hall.
Who, Canned Heat?
Canned Heat with John Lee Hooker.
I have that record. It's great.
Oh, that's Alan Wilson makes that shit. And
man.
He had just died. He had just OD'd.
The harmonica player?
Yeah.
Of Canned Heat.
But he was really kind of like the Brian Jones. I mean, he was really... the soul, musical soul. He was a genius, actually. Yeah. And we had nowhere to go afterwards. My uncle had this apartment on 57th Street, but we didn't really have anywhere to go. We were just standing on the corner of 6th and 57th.
Yeah.
And they came out.
After the show?
Yeah, like at a half an hour. And I said, you know, I play the harmonica, and I'm very serious about it. I'm a kid.
Yeah.
And I'll hitchhike to wherever you're playing next, and I'll meet you there if you let me sit in. They said, okay, we're at the Philadelphia Spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And they just lost their guy.
Two months before. But, you know, they were.
Right.
So we hitchhiked to Philadelphia and snuck into the Spectrum at like 3 in the afternoon.
They didn't even put you on the list?
Well, we didn't even know about lists. We snuck in and we sort of hid in the basement. And then we kind of worked our way up to the dressing room. Like, they were all, you know, what was so shocking was like, they were all so happy to see me. Like I was some long lost friend. And they said, well, play a little bit. And so I did. And then they said, okay, come on out. And I played in front of 20,000 people.
Oh my God.
You suddenly you're thrown out in front of 20,000 people and you're 16 years old and you play it. I think it went okay. And then you leave the stage, and then you're in this kind of nasty part of town, I mean, where the Spectrum was, and so we're just wandering around. Finally, the police came by, said, you can't walk around this neighborhood at 2 in the morning. Well, we have nowhere to go. And they drove us over to Temple University, and we slept on the couches there and then hitchhiked back.
Oh, God, that's a good story. So you were a blues guy.
Starting.
Yeah, but you loved it.
Yes.
And then how does it start to change? When did you pick up a saxophone?
So, I mean, how I got the saxophone is just a bizarre story that nobody believes, but I'll tell you. But basically, all the musicians I looked up to were from Boston, and they were all into jazz.
Boston guys?
Yeah, Boston, really good blues players, but they were all listening to Dolphy and Coltrane and stuff. I listened to that shit, and it's like, what? It was like, is this Chinese? I don't get it. And so because there was something I didn't understand, I started... But how I got the saxophone, nobody, I'll tell you the story.
Okay.
Because this was like God coming and saying, John, this is what we
want. But up to that point, you played harmonica. Guitar, no guitar?
I played guitar, yeah.
Were you good?
Not yet. I was also studying classical guitar, but the harmonica was the thing I was good on.
Where were you studying classical guitar?
There in, you know.
In Worcester? At a music store or what?
No, at some guy's house. Some bitter guy who, you know, hated everything.
Yeah, hold the guitar on the other knee.
Yeah.
Okay. So you, all these guys in Boston, saxophone.
So Babe Pino was the big harmonica guy in Boston. I couldn't stand him. Like really creepy hair and creepy clothes, but he just had some licks. He wasn't really good. He just had these impressive licks.
Oh yeah.
But they came to Worcester to play.
Yeah.
With Michael Avery, who was I was close with Michael, and Bob Margolin, who played with Muddy Waters later.
Yeah, I know that name.
Muddy Waters used to call him Guitar Goonie.
Uh-huh.
And, but I asked to sit in. And Michael. But Michael was uncomfortable because it was Babe Pino's gig, and he was a harmonica player. And then I sat in.
Yeah.
But they didn't give me Babe Pino's pride, you know, special microphone.
Right.
I just had this Shure microphone, and there was nothing in the monitors. But I'd never been on stage before, so I don't even know. But it's a disaster. I can't hear a note I'm playing.
Yeah.
And I'm playing so hard trying to hear myself that it's just musical nonsense. Right. And they kind of like sneer at me afterwards, and I'm really...
You got set up.
Well, not exactly,
you didn't
but
have a good mic. They didn't give you a monitor.
But I just thought, this is going to be the kid comes on. Oh, the kid is good and is going to be carried out on their shoulders. And it was a disaster.
Yeah.
And my dad had just died. And I colored in my college board. So if I don't go to college, I'm going to go to Vietnam.
Right.
And I'm just depressed.
Yeah.
And I'm just walking around Worcester, Massachusetts at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm supposed to go to high school in a couple hours, and I'm just like And I run into this guy. And he's got a wheelbarrow full of dirt. This fat black guy with this weird smile on his face on Main Street in Worcester, Massachusetts at 4 o'clock in the morning when there's nobody.
Right.
So I start talking to him.
Yeah.
And he tells me that he's just seen a statue turn into an angel and fly away. And this is the kind of thing I'm looking for at this point. You know, it's like, and so, and then he tells, he starts explaining to me that you could make amplifiers out of cotton.
Uh-huh.
And he's doing it. And I walk him home, and his mother's sleeping, so I have to be quiet. And he gives me a bicycle and a tenor saxophone with no case.
Uh-huh.
So I have to ride the bicycle home with the saxophone. That's how I started playing the saxophone.
He had a wheelbarrow full of dirt, a bicycle, and a saxophone.
Oh, he was going to plant an organic garden on his roof.
So he stole his dad's saxophone.
No, I brought them back in a week. It was his saxophone.
Yeah. So that's how you got the saxophone?
The first one, and I practiced. And I had this.
You didn't take any lessons?
No.
You just had a feel for it?
No, but what had happened was I was determined after the guitar lessons.
Yeah.
To approach this from a completely innate thing.
Yeah.
I didn't even buy a finger chart for the first several months. And I would just go up onto this Newton Hill, which was in the middle, and just blow my brains out for hours in the middle of the night. Just because that was kind of the style then, too.
Yeah.
And then slowly but surely, I got a finger chart and figured out the notes and started,
And then how'd you not go to the war?
I got a high lottery number.
Mm. Scary, huh?
Well, no, because I had friends who got out. They would put like peanut butter in the crack of their ass. You know about this?
I've heard about the stories.
And
apparently
it worked.
They
eat the peanut butter.
How many times they got to see that shtick before they're like, you know what? All these guys can't be eating their shit.
No, but I think that even if even if they knew it was only peanut butter, they think, well, if the guy's going to bother to do that, let's just let him go.
So when was the first combo?
Oh, not forever.
So you're just jamming sax by yourself?
Yeah, practicing on my own, yeah.
And where are you working at that point? You stayed in Worcester?
No, I moved to Boston. Yeah. Then I went to London.
Boston? Where'd you live in Boston, man?
In Brookline first.
Oh, yeah, I lived up in Brookline.
But then I went to London, and I would play saxophone on the street.
You just went to London by yourself?
Well, my mother, after my dad died, moved back to Wales to take care of her mom.
Oh, really?
And then my brother was over there living in a squat.
In Wales or London?
In London. He was in London. My mother was in Wales. And he made it sound like it was wonderful there. And so I got there and it was just like, this is a disaster, Evan. You know?
Well, how bad was it? No water, no heat, no...
Sometimes, you know? And then, you know...
What was he doing?
He loved it.
But what was he working on?
He was playing the piano and...
Yeah. And this is what, the 70s? Early 70s?
I don't know what year is this.
I don't know.
I'm 21, so 50, it's...
60,
it's,
72, right? 73.
Yeah, 72, 73, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I started playing the saxophone on the street.
Yeah. Annoying people? Were people putting money in to stop you? Like that guy in the train in New York? There used to be a guy in the train in New York who would get on a car and be so irritating with the fucking sax, you gave him money to...
Money to stop?
Basically. You've seen him?
No, but I pay a lot of people to stop playing music. I mean, I pay some large dollars for a lot of people to stop playing.
All right, so you're doing that. Are you playing lyrically? Are you playing Coltrane riffs? Are you making sense?
Yeah. No, I'm playing, going back and forth. I'll play Sweet Georgia Brown and then a Coltrane thing, and I'm not like squawking my brains out. I'm finding stuff. I'm not out of control.
Yeah.
But I discovered, one night I'm playing... And you know the soccer guys, the football what are they called? Yabos?
Yeah, I don't know.
They're out of control. And I'm in Piccadilly Circus, and some guy just comes by and punches me in the face. I got my eyes closed, and I'm playing, and I end up on the ground.
Yeah.
And then I discovered when there all these soccer guys are in Midtown or whatever you would call it, you get them to stand behind your saxophone case and sing their song, their team song. and people just throw a fucking fortune into your case. Yes. It works great until the other fans of the other team come by and start fighting with them, and then you kind of like close up your case and move to the next corner.
So you're a front man for a soccer team that you switch sides on?
Yeah,
every
switch sides
on
and then run away.
That's good.
And then once I got arrested, I mean, they're so polite there. You know, they said, you must stop playing now or you will be picked up. Okay, I keep playing, and they come and they arrest me. And I get arrested with all the one-man band guys, you know, with the drums on their back and the guitar. And the budgie man, the guy who has all the birds that do the tricks.
Yeah.
And Dancing Hitler and all these guys, right?
Dancing Hitler? And of course, that famous guy, the Dancing Hitler.
He was famous. I think he really may have been Hitler, so don't turn your nose up at the dance. So we're in this cell the size of this room, like eight, and I think there's going to be some kind of camaraderie, you know. But most of them are junkies, like waiting to get out of there at 8 o'clock so they can get.
Yeah.
And they're the meanest fucking people I ever met. Yeah. And plus, I'm a Yank. They really hate me even more.
So you're getting shit from the guy with the drum on his back?
The police were much nicer than the musicians. Yeah. The police were very apologetic, you know.
Did you go to New York next?
Where do I go next? Yeah, I came back to and went to New York. Yeah.
And now it's what, 70 what?
78, 77.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that's when shit is kind of wild there, right? I mean, it's getting a little better economically, but it's still a little blown out. The Lower East Side is for real. Art scene's for real.
I don't know. I got a job. My uncle got me a job at the Plaza Hotel.
Doing what?
I was the night housekeeping dispatcher, which was really perfect.
Are you playing music?
Well, I'm practicing still.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to find God through the saxophone, basically, is what I'm doing. And so by 4 to 6 o'clock, I would have to work. And after that, there would hardly be anything unless, you know, Milton Berle wanted some more pillows, and I'd have to send them down. But otherwise, I could go
really?
Up into
Did you get Milton Berle pillows?
Yes, I sent Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Did you get to talk to him? Did you deliver the pillows to Milton Berle?
No, you call somebody who brings them down.
Oh, you couldn't even go do the thing.
Well, not like I wanted to.
What do you mean? He's Milton Berle. You don't want him. You weren't curious?
At the time, no, I might be now. But no, I would, no, you know.
Fuck Milton Berle at the time.
Yeah, no, it's like just, you know, and I would practice up on the roof, you know, and hope to not miss any calls.
Yeah.
Plus, you could also get keys to rooms.
Yeah.
You knew were vacant and sleep there. And it was,
oh, you did that?
Yeah.
The Plaza? It's nice. Yeah.
Then my horn got stolen, and I moved to Boston.
Oh, boy.
I drove a cab and did some sort of scams a little bit, and then I moved back to New York for good.
Scams?
Well, if I... Yeah, I mean,
there's statute of limitations. Like,
is
what?
There?
Probably. I don't know. Did you kill someone?
No.
All right.
I went. What? It's kind of good.
All right. Well, then let's do it. And then you think about it and you call me later in a panic.
Will you call your lawyer and ask him if it's
all
right?
Call your lawyer.
I don't have a lawyer.
Well, okay. I'll call my lawyer. What was the scam?
So I thought, what if I couldn't work because I was psychologically unable, but not so bad that they'd have to put me somewhere?
Right.
So I went to see, like, you know, this kind of like junior league social psychiatrist kind of thing.
Yeah.
And said, you know, and then she recommended me for supplement Social Security.
Uh huh.
And then I got like $200 a month.
Okay. For being slightly off.
Yeah.
Did you play it up? What'd you do? What'd you?
I would kind of just, you know, they'd send you to these government psychiatrists, and I would just sort of like suss him out to know what, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, do you hear voices? And if you found that if you looked at him directly in the eyes and he was terrified, then you just keep staring him at the eyes, and then he signs your paper and sends you away. You
know? Oh, okay. Like, yeah.
So, you know, you just kind of figure it out. But then I went to get my money, you know. You know, there's all these kind of crazy people on this gigantic thing. And this guy comes in and he goes, I want my money. And he's this fat guy. And he gets down on one knee and holds a fist up over his head. And I was like, man, he's got me beat. He goes, I want my money. And they just wanted him out, you know. Like, and they gave him his money and got him out, you know.
But sort of.
I couldn't go that far, you know.
It was a theme. That was like the saxophone angle, too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, all right. So then what? You moved to New York permanently?
I moved to New York, yeah.
And what was the plan?
It wasn't a plan.
Well, you must have wanted to do something.
I really never had a plan.
You got a saxophone.
I had a saxophone.
$200 a month for being a fake lunatic.
Yeah. And I started dealing pot a little bit, and
Oh yeah, back when people had to come over and you had to, like, you know, you weren't delivering pot. You had
No.
Did you meet some good people?
No, I was terrible at it too. And then I moved to Third Street and got this $55 a month apartment.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Between what and what?
Second and Third, where the men's shelter block was.
Yeah, I lived on Second between A and B.
Oh, that's close.
And yeah, we were neighbors, kind of.
When was that?
It was 89 to 92.
Oh, I was gone by then.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we started the band.
You and your brother,
Arto Lindsay.
Yeah, Arto Lindsay.
Anton Fear and Steve Piccolo.
Oh shit!
Yeah,
that was the original Lounge Wizards.
Yeah.
That's a monster lineup.
It really was.
Yeah, man.
Anton Fear can really play the drums. I mean, it's like, I kind of didn't really know at the time how good he was, but he was really good.
Yeah, he did the, he went on to do Golden Palominos, right?
And, yeah, he's still playing.
Yeah.
Steve Piccolo is really musically brilliant, too.
Yeah,
and
Lindsay
Ardo's
too.
Got his thing. Yeah, I mean.
Everyone's got their thing.
Yeah.
The context was not pop music. It was definitely experimental.
Well, what came right before us?
Yeah.
And it seems like now it was 10 years before us, but it was like probably 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Were Theoretical Girls, Boris Policeman, The Contortions, DNA.
Right.
Which were probably about, you know, 10 days after Television, Blondie, Talking Heads. I mean, but this kind of wilder stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we were right after that. But it was just, there was no time at all.
Right.
But it seems like it must have been several years in between those things.
Different generation.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of picked up where they left off.
Kind of. But my thing was in jazz, you know, deeply, deeply in jazz.
And you were doing you were composing.
Yeah.
But more improvising or not? Did you write music?
Well, what I was doing first was I wanted to make a serious movie, and I had the naive idea that if I wrote the score first, it would be easy. Because I watched these people with scripts trying to get money to make it. I was like, that's no fun. I don't want to do that. So I wrote the score for a movie I wanted to make called Fatty Walks.
Right.
And I thought, if I write the music, I'll go into the money people and play these things and explain what's happening. And this is...
That's the most backward thing I've ever heard. Well, that you're going to go in and pitch a movie like, look, it doesn't matter what the movie is. Just listen to this. So you would play it. What, you'd play a little bit?
I know, it was silly, but you
know. No, I like it.
It didn't, I mean, I never even got that far because then, you know, the Lounge Wizards had their first gig and that was the music that we used for that first gig.
Was the Lounge Wizards, were you trying to do something serious or not?
No, it was what's a good band to play on a Monday night before Peter Gordon.
Yeah.
I said, my band not having one. And then I had this music I was working on and we threw this thing together.
Yeah.
And Tony actually made us rehearse. Otherwise, it would have just been, you know, because me and Arto were kind of sloppy those days. And, you know, and we were the eldest. And
what, drug sloppy?
No, sloppy about...
doing the thing, the music.
Me and Arto did this thing.
Yeah.
After the Lounges, it was like 6 months into it.
Yeah.
Arto wanted to do a thing at the Kitchen. And the Kitchen was a big deal then. It was almost like BAM, you know?
Yeah.
Let's apply to do something at the Kitchen. Mm-hmm. I was like, what? I said, let's do a dance performance, Arto. Because I'm just fucking with him. He said, okay.
Yeah.
And so he applied, and we got it.
Yeah.
And so what it says in the program is two lanky fellows jump up and down for their money.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And it was so embarrassingly bad. And I mean, people just, it was just the worst thing.
How did you judge the worst then when people were doing such experimental shit?
This wasn't even trying to be good. Yeah. I mean, we played this Morricone music and me, you know, that down there. And me and Arto, we had a sunset projected against the wall.
Yeah.
And me and Arto in cowboy outfits just sort of stood there with our hands on our hips.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, it was kind of a fuck you to the performance thing, you know.
Yeah,
it was,
right.
And then this cloppity clop, and we sort of started cloppity clopping around. Uh-huh. Then we did dance improv for about 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It was called I Love a Tornado. And then
else are you going to call it?
And then we built this tornado structure, and we had this wind machine that didn't work. So we got inside there and shook it. And then we got out and took a bow, and people sort of left grimly. And Evan, who was still there, said, you guys have a lot of nerve. I mean, I think he would have left too if I wasn't, he wasn't my brother. You know, he kind of had to stay.
Yeah.
You know, we kept gigging. I remember walking down the street with Art. I was like, if I could just make $200 a month doing this, that would just be unbelievable.
Doing the cowboy shtick?
No, no, I was never going to do that. I was embarrassed.
Yeah. So, all right. So you do the Lounge Wizards. Let's, I want to get into the movies and stuff because, like, you definitely have, you know, people, you know, you're a memorable guy. So you tour with the Lounge Wizards?
Yeah, that's all we did forever.
For how long?
Oh, from 82 to 98, 99.
Jesus Christ.
That's what I did for years and years and years. And we couldn't even get record deals. I mean, I put out some of the records on my own.
Yeah.
But basically, yeah.
How was the audience? Did it hold up? I mean,
I mean, in Europe, we played in Milan one night. Sold out place, 5,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Winter Marsalis was down the street. It was a quarter full. Patti Smith was the other way.
Yeah.
It was a quarter full. We, you know, we were...
Packed?
Packed everywhere all the time. In Europe and Japan.
Yeah.
America, it would be like 150 people.
Right.
You know, like...
So most of your money was made international touring.
Yeah.
And when you were, like, when you were in New York, when it started... What you were like, sort of one of a kind in that period, right?
Yeah,
there was no one doing what you were doing.
No.
It was mostly, what was it? Was that after No Wave or before?
Right after.
So it was kind of punk rock still, or what was going on down there?
It was a little confusing. I mean, the band didn't get good till like 84.
Yeah.
We were kind of this novelty act in
same,
the beginning.
The same lineup, or did you?
No, we switched a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you play with Mark Rebo?
Yeah, Rebo came into the second band. Yeah,
yeah, he's a trippy guitar player, man.
He's a great guitar player.
Yeah, and so like, and so he ended up playing a lot of the Waits albums as well, right?
Yeah.
And you're friends with Tom?
Not so much anymore. And, you know, Tom came, you know, came to see us a whole bunch of times and then stole my guitar player, Rebo, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of like,
so
kind of lower than stealing somebody's girlfriend. You don't steal somebody, because it was a band, you know?
Yeah.
That was not right.
But did that happen before or after you did Fishing with John with him?
Before.
So you guys were okay to do the fishing show?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah,
I mean, it wasn't like, I'll kill you, you stole my guitar player, but it was just kind of like, come on, man, it's not the right thing to do, you know?
Do you like his shit?
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah.
He's actually really unusual.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he was nervous to do the fishing show.
Was he?
Which shocked me.
Yeah.
Because who on earth could be better than to just throw out random lines about what's happening, because he's a genius. And there's nobody like him.
Yeah.
You know, there's one thing where he's casting, we're using live bait, and he casts awkwardly, and the fish smashes onto the... And I said, come on, Tom, the idea is to keep him alive.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, I'm not a doctor. But he's just, you know... And so that he was nervous to do it, where he was the best equipped person to do it,
right,
was weird to me.
Well, when did you first start acting?
I haven't started yet.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, I made these Super 8 movies.
But what happened to the Walking with Fatty movie?
That never happened.
What was that about?
It was just about the weirdest things I'd encountered in New York, you know, as a young man, going from one thing to another. There was some bad guys, and
loose plot.
Yeah, but I made these two movies. But I made The Men in Orbit, which was a simulated Apollo documentary, but we just filmed it on LSD.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of good, but unbearable at the
same
time.
Did you digitize it?
I don't know. It's on video now.
Oh, you okay? Yeah. What I mean, you can get it.
No, you can't get it.
But
it's horrible. But
what was the other Super 8 one?
Was called Hell Is You, where I interviewed James Chance.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Is he still around?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's dead?
I don't know.
No, he's still alive.
Does he still play?
I don't know.
Okay. Why is it so surprising to ask if someone's dead or not? I mean, Jesus Christ, look around.
I know. It's really... there's got to be a better way. You know, you change the channels...
Yeah.
And it says, David Bowie dies.
Yeah.
This is not the way to find out that somebody you knew and cared about died. It's just wrong. Or on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
How do you want to find out? Do you want someone to come over?
Here's how I want to find
out. Say, like, can you sit down for a minute?
Here's how I want to find out. Because I'm 63. My brother's 61.
Yeah.
Now it's happening more and more often.
Right.
I get a phone call from Evan.
Mm-hmm.
He says, John, I have some bad news.
Mm-hmm.
I know what's coming next, but it gives me a moment to settle in. Hope it's not somebody too close, but just to be ready for who died.
Right.
That's all I want. So they should have on CNN, they should have Evan come on and go, John, we have some bad news. And then David Bowie dies. You know, that's how it should go. Right. Or they... Not, I mean, anybody but Don Lemon could say it.
Right.
Anderson Cooper could come on. Yeah. We have some bad news. And then, let me get ready. Okay.
Right. Well, that's a reasonable request.
Isn't it?
Not from a television, but from people.
Well, but that's how you find, I mean, Twitter, it's like I found out so many friends died from Twitter. It's just like.
Well, yeah, it's.
I don't like it.
Well, get off Twitter.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. I haven't been on that long.
Yeah. So, all right. So, but when did you, how did you get involved with Jarmusch? When did, what was the first one?
Stranger
Than Paradise.
No, the first one I played on the street and did the score for Permanent Vacation, and they stored the equipment at my house.
And that was a Jarmusch movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? So you knew him when he was a kid, and you were a kid, basically.
Well, he was going to film school. I met him during the Eric Mitchell movie.
Yeah.
Red Italy.
Uh-huh.
But the most amazing thing about the movie Permanent Vacation was Jean-Michel Basquiat, the painter, used to sleep on my floor in the front room. And he had to... If I'm jealous about anything, I'm a little jealous about you interviewing Obama.
Yeah.
But I'm more jealous of people who can sleep anywhere at any time. And Jean-Michel could sleep anywhere.
Yeah.
And so he used to sleep on my rug in the front room, and they're storing the film there.
Yeah.
And he was so asleep that they could pick him up and move him from another place.
Was he on drugs?
No, he's just been, you know, out for a few days, and now he's sleeping.
Yeah.
And they would move him.
Mm-hmm. And you're jealous of that.
People can sleep anywhere.
What about his painting? He's also a pretty beautiful painter.
He's a great painter. Yeah. No, I'm not jealous of that. I'm jealous of the sleeping.
Yeah, I can't sleep everywhere.
I used to have this drummer, Dougie Bound, 5'2".
Yeah.
He'd fall asleep on the plane. He'd fall asleep on the... Just in a second... I get so pissed off, I'd wake him up. I couldn't stand it. I mean, I really hate... I mean, jealous.
I can only sleep on planes right before takeoff. For some reason, when they change the pressure in the cabin, I go out. And then as soon as the plane takes off, I'm up. And that's that.
Oh, no, if I sleep, the plane will crash.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's usually what causes all crashes.
Yes.
The scared guy falls asleep.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's true.
All right, so you do Permanent Vacation, but when... Because I think the first time I saw you act was in the Stranger Than Paradise. He just had a good presence on there, man. Yeah, good presence. Yeah, like you're kind of heavy.
Heavy?
Not fat, but like intense, man. You're menacing.
Really?
I don't, sometimes.
Sometimes, but...
Maybe just cranky.
Cranky. My acting style is curmudgeon. Curmudgeon from the curmudgeon school of acting.
Yeah.
I mean, Jim had a little bit of... We had a little bit of film left over from the vendor's state of things.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to do. He was writing this thing that was just the Garden of Divorce, which was this futuristic sci-fi.
Yeah.
And it was terrible.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, let's just do this. And I pushed him. Yeah. So we shot this little half-hour movie. And then he got, 2 years later, he got the rest of the money.
Yeah.
To finish it.
Yeah, it's a sweet movie. It changed everything somehow.
Did it?
A little bit. It was like this thing that, like, it was that generation of independent movies. Like, it wasn't, like, it sort of started something.
See, I never quite understood that because the Cassavetes and Fassbenders and
but that wasn't for the kids.
It wasn't for the kids.
He got a whole generation of people going, like, I'm going to make a movie.
Yeah.
You know, Fassbender and Cassavetes are like, I'm never going to make a movie like that.
Oh, yeah.
But, Jarmusch made that movie like, I can make a movie.
It was something very sweet about it.
Yeah.
And something charmed.
Yeah.
I mean, we were so lucky because it was like one guy got the flu, that would have been done.
Well, I think Louis just used the woman in it.
Esther.
Who I think Louis used her recently.
Yeah, I think he did.
Yeah. Did she do a lot of acting after that?
No, not so much.
Yeah.
She plays violin, too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So, all right, so then would you consider that you had a movie career after that? You were kind of a New York kind of face. Like, you'd see you in movies, you gave it credibility somehow.
Really? Yeah,
that's John Lurie, the New York guy.
No, then like a cameo. Because, I mean, I couldn't act. I mean, I had no...
I know, but you look good.
But I had no chops. I wasn't a legitimate... I mean, I was in a Lynch movie, a Wenders movie, a Scorsese movie, but I really just to do that.
I thought you were good in Down by Law. That was a while.
I came and went. I was good for a while. I mean, Benigni's.
Well, yeah, yeah.
But he, you know.
But you were good. It seemed to fit you good.
I did okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then you did, that's right, you were in The Last Temptation of
Christ. Yes, I was. I was St. James. I don't know why you're laughing. Fuck. How dare you? I'm a serious actor. Oh, you motherfucker. Let me tell you something.
I saw it the first time, like, shit, that John Lurie's got a beard.
So the first day, me and Vicar.
Didn't you have a beard, or am I making that up?
No, I had a beard.
Yeah, yeah.
And a wig.
Yeah, yeah.
But my beard.
Yeah, and you were in the desert?
We're in Morocco.
Yeah.
So the first scene is we're moving these fish, me and Vic Argo, and they're old, stinky fucking fish.
Yeah.
And Vic is being very careful, but I'm going to be a good actor here. I'm going to get into moving my fish.
Yeah.
And they get all over my robe, my costume.
Yeah.
And then the costume, and the continuity people, they won't let them clean my robe because they're not sure if it's going to screw up. Even though the story takes place over 5 years, they won't let them clean my robe.
Right.
And I've got all this fish stink on my robe.
Yeah.
So anytime I stand still anywhere, flies come. I mean, I'm like attracting flies everywhere I go.
And that was not part of the Apostle James's story?
Acting. Fuck acting.
James
Jesus.
Was not the attractor of flies in the Bible?
He was, no. The man of stink? No.
The man of stink. Where's that record?
I'll work on it. The man of stink. Sounds more like a poem, though.
Sure. Yeah. Work on either one of them. I had Favino in here. Jimmy.
Yeah.
And he brought up this, there was a controversy. Did you write the Conan O'Brien theme song?
Not the one you hear.
No?
Were you going to say controversy? I'll tell you how it happened. I had been through this horrible thing with this lawyer and assistant doing really bizarre things, like how I lost the fishing show, and I was really lost all my money. And the lawyer who I paid to help me out of some of this, so, you know, they're going to make this new TV show. It's going to be like, you know, Letterman or something. And maybe you could be the band leader.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, if I play the music I want, they'll let me stay for a month and then fire me and it will be great.
Yeah.
It'll be like when Jimi Hendrix opened for the Monkees or something. Yeah. You know, it's like, and I'm running off to the audition and Conan had said that they wanted something that sounded like the Jetsons.
Yeah.
So I wrote this really tight harmon mute thing that sounded kind of like Thelonious Monk Jetsons kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then Howard Shore calls me. He's the guy who was going to, he's a big deal.
Yeah, Howard Shore. Yeah, he's a big music guy.
And he's the one who's supposed to find somebody, and he wants me, and everybody wants me but Conan. I said, why? And he said, well, Conan thinks you're funnier than him, and that scares him. Well, okay. But I have good news. They're going to use our theme.
Yeah.
Our theme. Yes, I've taken what you wrote and changed it a little bit. And I'm thinking, like, who gave you the right to do that? Who the fuck do you think you are, you know?
Right.
But I'm thinking also, the money's going to be good, you know? Yeah. It's okay. And then nothing. I don't hear anything.
Yeah.
Then Conan comes on the air and they're using it. But there's no credit for me. No credit for anybody, actually. And I don't know what to make of this. But I, because of what had happened to me.
What happened?
Well, I had this assistant and lawyer who sold the fishing show and this concert film, and all my money was stolen. I lost everything back, like, the year before that. So I was really skeptical. So after my audition with the Conan show, I sent my audition tape to the library, you know, copyrighted it.
Yeah.
Which is nuts.
Yeah.
Who does that?
A guy who got fucked.
A guy who got fucked, but it still was. I mean, I thought, as I put it in the mailbox, I was like, you're fucking nuts to be doing this. But, so now it's on.
Yeah.
And Howard, I said something about it in an interview somewhere, and they kind of misquoted me, and it was worse than it looked.
Yeah.
And then he wouldn't speak to me anymore. And so they're just playing this thing. So then we had this lawyer call, and they said, well, we don't really know this. I was like, we've copyrighted it. And I had him by the balls. Just had to wait long enough so it actually became the theme. And then, you know, I made... And I wrote it in, like, less than 5 minutes. I mean, I just... Stephen Bursey, I said, okay, listen, Stephen Bursey wrote it down really quickly, and then we nailed it.
Yeah.
And I like the way we did it, and I hate the way. I can't stand the way. I mean, I almost didn't want to. But, yeah, so that's how it went. And who knows what Howard Shore's thing was. I mean, I'd love to talk to him about it. I'd love to actually, because I liked Howard, and I'd like to kind of trust him on this. But I got a lot of people afterwards calling me and saying, you know, Howard stole music from me, too, but you don't know who to believe about any of
this. Sure.
I mean, he's written some good stuff.
How long did they use the theme?
Until he was on the Tonight Show, and it was like, then he was even on the Tonight Show, and then until he got knocked off. And then, you know, when he came back, they used something else.
So a long time.
A long time. I mean, it was paid my bill when I got sick.
Yeah, you made
the
money.
I had no money coming in.
Ba-da.
No, but I didn't write that part. I just wrote, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da sweet what we
did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I didn't write that. Wada. I hate that.
That's where you draw the line.
Yeah,
draw the line. Wada. Sorry, man.
Sorry. Just
but that got you through. It's amazing about show business, isn't it?
Here's the other
when
way.
When you lock into something.
The other way, I used to do a lot of voiceover stuff. Yeah. And my agent was really stuck by me when I was really sick and I couldn't really function. And I was doing Animal Cops.
Uh-huh.
But I was too sick to be doing them. I mean, I would say the Detroit Humane Society. And then after like a half an hour in the booth.
Really?
Yeah, because anything I would use would stop work, but I couldn't let them. And I just imagine my obituary saying, towards the end, he managed to keep his job on Animal Cops. And they fired me.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me the job doing Toyota.
Yeah.
Toyota Corolla.
Yeah.
Now that's moving you forward. Except they hired me, but they wanted a high-pitched, friendly voice, which I couldn't understand why.
Yeah.
And then they weren't going to use me anymore. Maybe I shouldn't tell this on the air because it might get him in trouble. You know what? I'm going to stop. But I made more money for the five-minute Conan thing and not appearing on Toyota Corolla commercials than I made doing anything else.
That's an amazing thing that it carried you that long. I love the stories about people making money in their sleep. You know, like that the idea that you wrote this piece and it was protected and it, you know, it paid off.
Wait, but you know, I did some, you know, I did things you do to try to make money, and then you lose all your money. You know,
well, how'd you lose all your fucking money?
Several different ways.
What, just investing your own money in projects?
Giving people money, paying, getting people out of jail, paying for rehabs, you know, like, you know, things like that.
Friends?
Then, yeah. Well, what were friends until I was in trouble?
Yeah.
You know, and then, I don't know.
You mean when you got sick, nobody came and helped you?
Some people, but... Oh, let's not.
How do you know Flea?
Flea's a sweetheart.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Sweethearts.
Yeah.
I was out here doing, first I met him was, I was out here doing the music for a not very good movie.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted them to not hire everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to write these funk things.
For which movie?
I don't remember the name of it. It was like a motorcycle, futuristic motorcycle movie.
You did quite a few movies, though.
I did a bunch of movies.
Mystery Train, Down by Law, Get Shorty, that's big.
Yeah, that's big.
You must have made a few bucks on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Fishing with John, that's Excess Baggage, is that the one?
That's a good score.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's a really good score.
Yeah, what's that movie about?
Oh, I don't know. It's some... Benicio del Toro and Alicia Silverstone.
Uh-huh. You work hard. You like doing that work?
I used to like it, but like that was a bad experience, that one.
Yeah.
They don't care about the movie.
Yeah.
You do these Hollywood movies, nobody cares if it's any good or not.
Right.
They only care about who returns whose phone call.
Right. And if it makes money.
Well, they don't even seem to care about that. They really only care about who returns whose phone call.
Yeah.
If you make the movie good, it might make money.
Right.
But, you know, it's like, well, there's a car horn at the end of, you know, at the, you know, 2 minutes into, well, what's the car, what does it sound like? Oh, we don't know, just write some music. It's like, no, you want to make a good, I mean, it takes a lot of work to make things good and people have to care, you know?
When you score a film, what do you do? You sit with the film?
Well, you watch it once.
Yeah, without any music.
Sometimes they have temp music.
Right.
And sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
And then you watch it one, like on your own. I just leave a tape recorder going at the keyboard or with a guitar,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of play the first thing that comes to your mind. And 80% of the time, that works. And then you kind of modify it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it often works.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you meet Flea?
Oh, I met Flea. Well, I was out here doing this movie score, and I wanted to. So I called Matt Dyke. You know Matt Dyke?
No.
from Delicious Vinyl. Is that what it was called? With
maybe
Tone Loc.
Uh huh.
You know, this is, he was doing some stuff back then.
Yeah.
And Sir Mix-a-Lot, I think, was on, you know, that stuff.
Yeah.
So, man, I need a really funky bass player. You got to get this kid, the Flea. Get the Flea.
Yeah.
So I called this kid. And I was, you know, because I had this stuff in 5/4 and in 7/8. And could you do this? And he could do it, you know. And he comes in, and, you know, there's all these outfits from the movie, mm-hmm. like leather jackets with, like, cups stapled to them and stuff. Yeah. And he like goes, oh, what's this? And he puts it on. He says, can I have this? I don't know. Just take it. And he walked out onto Sunset Boulevard. Where, and I was just like, I really was jealous. You know, I was like, how could you have the balls to walk out there wearing? So he was supposed to play on this thing. And then he showed up like hours late. You know, it was going to be him and Hillel and Cliff Martinez were going to play on the. And they showed up hours late. And the L.A. guy just kind of looked at me and was like, see, I knew I shouldn't let you hire anybody. And then that was it. Yeah.
As the drugs, man.
I guess.
Back then. But how so you, you've gone in and out with that shit, with the drinking and stuff?
I mean, that's a long arc of a story. I mean, no, I mean, I was a junkie.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and would freebase during, cocaine.
During the Lounge Wizards?
Yeah, during a lot of it.
Yeah.
And I quit and then started again and then quit and then I drank and then I quit and then I did nothing forever.
Yeah.
And then at some point I started drinking with this whole thing, this horrible stuff that happened with, and I'd gotten a little better with the Lyme disease. But I started drinking and I found that it quelled the nervousness. You know, I used to drink a bottle of vodka on the road every night and then come home.
Yeah.
And not drink.
Yeah.
And not even think about it.
Yeah.
And that drinking got under my skin like that. Yeah. It was shocked me. So I took me a while to kind of.
Sure.
You know,
but you were strung out on the dope for a while?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I never did that shit. I mean, I'm clean, you know, but I never took to the heroin.
I love the combination of heroin and cocaine at the same time. Yeah.
That was the thing, right?
Yeah, just to balance it out alchemically, perfectly. Yeah. And then, you know, if the coke ran longer than the heroin, then you were in hell.
Yeah.
You know, the heroin had to outlast the coke.
Right.
Because your nerves just couldn't handle it.
Yeah. So was it hard to kick that?
No, I did it many times.
So when
cigarettes are harder.
Yeah, cigarettes never go away.
Cigarettes were harder.
Yeah, they're just always there. Huh?
I'm still addicted to nicotine. I mean, you just chew this stupid gum.
I know.
You call me dude again?
Sorry.
Jesus.
I'm sorry. I don't know what it's a bad habit. I don't always do it.
Do I look like a dude?
No, but it's just like I usually say buddy.
Buddy's weird. I feel like I should sit on the same side of the table if you're going to call me buddy.
All right, well, John. How's John?
Weird. call me Friendo.
Hey, Friendo, listen. So after all is said and done here, we go through all this stuff, this amazing career, music, film.
Did you know that Obama stuck gum under the table?
I did know that. I just didn't tell anybody.
What a fucker.
Yeah. Don't take it.
Are you saving it there because it's his?
That's where the DNA is.
Oh, you're really nuts.
It's in the gum. Oh, is there really gum under there?
No, I was just teasing you.
I don't know who. I have a lot of people have sat over there. I don't know who took gum out.
Who's
and stuck
the last
it under
person
it
to stick sit here?
Cindy Crawford.
Really?
Yeah.
I was on the plane with her once.
Yeah.
And I was shocked at, like, the presence of her.
Yeah.
She was just, I just thought, you know, you see these people sometimes and they're nothing. But she was like.
Cindy Crawford.
Whoa. No, not that she was even, just as an entity.
Yeah.
She just kind of like, something radiated. And then we got off the plane. It was me and Buscemi were traveling together. And she goes, and they were like chasing her. Jeez, I mean, like, they were wild animals. It would look like hell to be her.
Well, the
paparazzi.
Yeah.
I mean, like.
How long ago was that?
A while, because me and Steve were, you know, Steve was kind of even unknown. So, I mean, like,
what were you
50,
doing with Steve?
We were just on the flight together. We've been pals forever.
Still pals?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
He's a sweet man. I mean, yeah.
So that's good. You held on to him.
Yeah.
You guys still friends.
He's a sweetheart. Him and Flea are just sweet. Will,
yeah, they are. Yeah.
You know, some show business people, you know, I got sick and they disappeared.
Yeah.
And then I was bitter for a while, and then I kind of felt sorry for them.
Yeah, you seem pretty good. I thought you'd be cranky. You seem good.
Well, I kind of geared myself to not be cranky when I got here.
What are you doing in L.A.?
it's kind of a fiasco of a trip. I'm here to do this.
Yeah.
Because I've been thinking about doing this forever.
Yeah.
But I was supposed to have a show at the New Orleans Museum of Art.
Yeah.
And
for the paintings.
Yeah. God, we hardly talked about the paintings.
We can talk about them. I mean, it seems like you paint one every day.
No, they go on. No, that's all. No, I don't paint one every day.
Well, on Twitter, I look at you. It's like, holy shit, did you just finish another one?
No, I cycle them out so I can kind of like, you know.
How many paintings are you churning out?
Like 3 a month, like 4 a month.
Maybe. And what are you working with? Watercolor?
Mostly
oil?
Watercolor now.
Yeah, I love it.
And I'm completely.
I love them.
You do?
I do.
The only one you ever retweeted was the one making fun of Time Warner Cable. Because
I'll retweet more if you want me to.
Yeah, all of them, yes.
But here's what's amazing to you. I'm pointing again.
Yeah.
Is that the persistence of your creativity, that after you move through all this stuff, whatever it is, acting, but mostly music, and then scoring movies, and then, you're just one of these guys that has a creative fever, that you find yourself doing these almost peaceful and... you look at your paintings and, you feel a warmth. It's almost, there's a childlike component. There's a primitivism thing. There's a, like, almost like a native element to it. And the colors are stunning. And, like, I'm happy for you that you paint. I'm serious.
That was really sweet, actually. I mean, I'm a big interrupter, and I don't like being complimented so much. But that was really nice. I enjoyed that, actually.
Yeah. I just, like, because, like, I don't know what it is, like, or whether I know a lot about you or not. For some reason, your presence in my mind has always been there, right? So then when I started seeing you on Twitter and it was kind of mysterious, I didn't know where you were, what you were doing. And
yeah, but that's by design. I mean,
no, I know that. Yeah. But we had a thing and whatever, but I've always been sort of fascinated with you. And when I first started seeing the paintings, I'm like, oh my God, this is what he's doing, and this is like some of the best shit he's ever done.
Yeah, it is. It actually, the painting has gone past everything. My soul, I mean, when I thought I lost music, I thought music was the only way I was going to find my soul in this universe. Uh-huh. But the painting has gone, is past it. It's past it. It's really.
So you actually find some peace with it?
Oh my God. I've been traveling for a minute and I haven't painted in a week. And yeah. I'm like, forget about cigarettes and heroin. It's just like, I want to get back to it. It's just like, I'm in it. Yeah. I'm just in it, you know?
Yeah, and you feel that. I must feel that. Cool. Like, I'm like, I'm happy for you. I'm serious.
Thanks.
And I don't even know you. I'm happy.
I mean, there is a weird thing with you and me. We must have run in parallel lines.
I don't know what it is. There
I bet you and me would fight all the time.
Eventually.
No, quickly, I think.
Really?
Yeah,
really, dude?
Oh, yeah, well. You're going to fuck with me. If you're going to fuck with me.
No, you're in a good mood. I thought maybe if I fuck with you in a good
then
mood.
Then call me dude. My doctor calls me dude, and I grab him by the lapels.
Really? Do you grab your doctor by the lapels
for calling
you dude?
Yeah, he's a small guy.
So you're doing 3 paintings a month.
About.
And you came, first of all, I interrupt you. What was this New Orleans thing that you were working on?
Oh, we were supposed to have this show. It was my year. This was my 2016, this big show at the museum in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And I was very excited. We were kind of planning everything around it. And then, so we were going to go now and choose. So I had 3 rooms, and there was a 4th room going to be an archival room. And I was, these Bayou painters, you know about them?
No.
They're just beautiful. Yeah. People don't know. So I was supposed to pick stuff from their archives that was going to go in this 4th room.
Curate a little bit.
Yeah, curate one room and then have my paintings in the other.
Yeah.
And then this guy, David Owen from San Francisco Sketchfest, a really sweet guy, has been bugging me forever to come there and screen Fishing with John and do a question and answer.
Sure.
We've been saying, no, I got Lyme disease, I can't do it again. And so I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'll go, because flying with the Lyme is still kind of hard.
Yeah.
You know, I had to come here, I had to rest the day before, rest the day after, and then leave. But, so I'll go to San Francisco, I'll come and do Marin, then I go to New Orleans, and then go back to my island.
Uh-huh.
And then we buy the tickets, we sign the contract with San Francisco, and New Orleans pulled out.
Ugh.
And just left. It felt.
And they pulled out that quick, like that close to short notice?
Well, no, because the thing wasn't scheduled until this coming summer.
Right.
But I had to go there in January to pick the archival room, and I planned my year around it. Held back works from Milan. No, it's just like, and their reasoning was, they didn't have the money.
Mm.
That they were only having shows that had corporate sponsorship.
Mm.
And then you start to think about why all the stuff you see in these museums sucks. It's because it has to have corporate sponsorship. Mm-hmm. And then what kind of art has corporate sponsorship? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's creepy.
Yeah, I know, but like they it seems to me that the middle person, whoever was in charge of the museum, could have championed you to any corporation. It's not like corporations are making decisions.
That's true, but the guy who was championing us wasn't the top guy.
Oh.
And I don't know, do I want, you know, who?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Pepsi? What?
I don't know.
Are you worried that a war contractor was going to...
That's a museum. There's money. Money comes to the museum. It's not because Pepsi-Cola gave them money.
There's money
for the museum to present great stuff. So don't present some plastic fucking dog that's worth $36 million for no reason.
Sure, sure.
People should be mad because art is important.
It is important.
I think.
No, definitely. Like I said, my girlfriend's an abstract painter. Yeah. And it's stunning. I can't even wrap my brain around where what you guys do comes from. It's beautiful, and it's an amazing thing.
But just the whole idea that what's showing in the museums is only there because it's sponsored by something corporate.
Yeah,
that's.
But I don't know if that's always what happens.
I don't know if it's always true, but it's just sort of, the whole thing's sort of scary because, you know, mostly what you look at is sucks.
Yeah.
You know,
the
so.
New stuff or in general? Who are your guys, you know, in terms of the older guys, the painters?
All through life, you mean?
Well, I mean, yeah, who do you like?
Pollock, Van Gogh, Bruegel, Schiele, Klimt. But Klimt I didn't discover until late, but I actually love him.
Yeah. I can see that.
Pollock.
Yeah.
Morris Louis.
Basquiat, well, you knew him.
Well, I knew him. I mean,
it's different.
Yeah, it's way different because he was just this kid, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I picked up some stuff from him. He picked up some stuff from me. We would just like, you know, get high and paint all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's too weird. It's like some kid in your neighborhood who followed you around and then became a big deal. Like, are you influenced? Huh?
That happened in New York.
But then it's like, were you influenced by the kid who followed you around? You're just like, damn. You know, it's kind of hard.
Sorry,
you know?
Yeah. 18. Are you comfortable on the island?
Yes.
You're having a nice time?
I love it there.
Good.
I got goats in the yard.
Really?
Yeah, and mango trees and iguanas, and I can see the ocean from every room, and it saved my health, because when I got there, I was like, you know.
Yeah.
I swim every day, which I never thought was going to be possible again.
And you got your own place?
I rent a place.
Yeah.
I didn't buy it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I love it there.
Well, good, man. I'm happy you're okay despite the problems.
No, man, this is like I came through the other side.
Yeah.
I survived shit that I know, and most people don't even know what I survived, but I know. And with her, too, she really stood by me. I mean, you know, I did a painting called The Other Side of the Great Wall of Fuck.
Yeah.
And it's for real, you know. It's like, but what I survived, it's like, you're a tough motherfucker. I'm proud of that. It feels good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, stay on the good side of it.
You know, I was going to ask if I could move in for a while.
We'll talk about it off the mic.
No. On mic. I got to talk.
That's why I become one of those guys who are like, I'd like to help you, John. You know, but I...
But where are we? In Pasadena?
Almost. Pasadena's over there. Glendale's over there. Eagle Rock's a little east of us. We're a little east of, you know, Mount Washington, Glassell Park, and Eagle Rock.
Now you're talking about places I never heard of.
We're east. Well, you're not an LA guy.
Well, I lived in Palm Springs for a while.
We're far from Palm Springs.
Well, I know, but I know east.
Yeah. Palm Springs is east of here.
It's east of here. Yeah.
We're west of Palm Springs. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I had fun.
Good. I did too.
It wasn't a disaster, right? We're not going to have to
No. I am truly happy for you, and I'm glad you came out through it. And, you know, we talked about what we needed to talk about or what you wanted to talk about. We don't have to do any more war stories. I just enjoyed seeing you.
You look really good, though, like better than any photographs. And I noticed on the recent photographs you look good.
Well, I think I relaxed a little bit. I'm a little more relaxed.
Well, you got a lot back from the world now. I mean, people love Marc Maron, and it actually makes a difference. After I did the thing in Milan and got all this great press, and they treated me with respect.
It's a relief, right?
And it was just kind of like... And I saw it in the mirror. I thought, well, did I change a vitamin? Did I get more sleep? It was like, no, it was just like...
Validation.
A little validation, you know. And it, But you can see it in your face.
Makes a difference when you work your whole fucking life at a bunch of different shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the chips are down, you don't know if shit's going to come back around. And somehow it slowly starts coming around. And you find something, like, not unlike you in painting, that you never anticipated ever doing.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And it turns out to be the thing that works for you and your heart. And also makes you appealing to others. And you know, it's a good thing.
Appealing to others.
Look, I know we're both men that have been the opposite of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't know why I like that asshole. I just, but he's pushing his luck.
Yeah.
You ready to, can we go?
No, let's keep talking forever.
Okay.
You're tired?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
I'm not tired.
Let's get out of here. I'm going to say something stupid if I haven't already.
All right, John, thanks. All right. I think we covered a lot of stuff. Yeah, it was pretty lively in here, my friends. Pretty lively with John Lurie. Go check out his stuff. You can go to WTFpod.com for all WTF Pod stuff. Okay? We can play some guitar, maybe. Boomer lives!